Hello and welcome to the QA Therapy podcast. Are you looking to improve your overall testing and quality practices? My name is Sergio Freire and I'm a solution architect and a testing advocate at X-Ray.
And my name is Cristiano Cunha and I'm also a solution architect and test advocate. And we'll be your hosts and QA therapists throughout this series. In this podcast, we're going to tackle some of the most common testing and quality challenges that we all face in our teams. So if this sounds good to you, keep on listening. In this episode, we will talk about accessibility. What are the principles, good practices? Why should we care? And how to validate that your application is accessible to a broader audience? To assist us on this topic, we have a special guest with us, Hadi Stokes. So let's think about what is bringing us here. What are the symptoms that you may have been feeling that I've brought you here? So ask yourself, do you and your team or organization know what accessibility is? Or do you feel that accessibility is not a priority? Or are you constantly fighting against accessibility myths, like you keep hearing, well, it's too expensive, it will take too much time, we are not trained in this topic, and we don't know what to do? Or even, do your team claims to have an accessible product, but only executes a few automation validations?
All these are symptoms that accessibility is not fully understood. Neither do we understand how important it is to have an application that is available to anyone. And today's we have here with us Hadi Stokes, our QA therapist, to assist on diagnosis and prescription on these symptoms related to accessibility. Welcome, Hadi. Are you feeling comfortable on our QA therapy couch?
Yes, I'm all fine, thank you. Very comfortable. I like the plush pillows.
So, and to highlight a bit more about this topic, let's start by trying to understand a bit more about what is accessibility all about.
So for me, one of the things I always say is, don't think about as accessibility as about disability, but more about inclusion. It's making sure that everybody can use your software, irrespective of what device they're using, whether they're using any assistive technology, whether they can only use a keyboard to navigate rather than a mouse, whether they're using a screen reader to hear what your site sounds like rather than actually see it. And for each of those specific examples there's a spectrum of different things. So people with low vision can often see elements of a website but still need a screen reader to make it all come to life. But equally, someone for whom English is not a first language, it's much easier to learn the spoken word of a language than the written word. So you will get people who can speak quite good English who will look at English websites with a screen reader, so they can make sense of the words on the screen, and it actually helps them then to learn the written word in a quicker way. So for every example where you say, well, this is for a specific thing, there's a lot more examples around that of where it also aids other people. So a common myth you hear is it's useful to everybody. Accessibility is useful to everybody. I've heard that said lots of times. Well, that's an incomplete sentence. The full sentence is, accessibility is useful to everybody, but vital to some people. So don't do it for everybody as much as do it for the ones it's vital for. Does that make sense?
What was the exact limitation that we're trying to address? Like you were saying, we have visual impairments, we have hearing, we have a lot of other things, even the example that you gave with the language. And we were, the other one was accessibility important for people, only important for people with limitations, that you end up also answering that no, but they will for sure get the most out of it. So let's go a little bit onto the principles. So is there a set of standards or rules that we can lean upon to have a better accessibility?
So the one that's the most widely quoted is the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, and that's available at w3.org. They use the principles of perceivable, operable, understandable, and robust to get the information across. The reason why people find accessibility quite difficult to access and get into is because in describing those four principles, there's literally thousands of pages behind it, which all come from I think there's 60 principles altogether in WCAG 2.1. I think there's 60 altogether because there's 12 more added when 2.1 came out, and they were more focused on the mobile space. So the original first two versions of the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines have about 10 years in between. And they haven't been updated in 2019 for 10 years. So in 2019, in June 2019, they were updated with another 12, which were more focused on the mobile world. Because if you think about it, in 2009, we weren't all using touchscreen devices. We didn't all have mobile phones and smartphones in our pockets. So web content accessibility was focused around browser-based web stuff. So they've tried to bring in more things that are relatable to mobile phones. So over these guidelines, these 60 guidelines, the guidelines in themselves seem straightforward, but they put thousands of pages and examples of understandings behind it to explain it. And that can be massively overwhelming for some people. Like, there are other sites out there like WHAG.com that break it down into simple language. And they give you a simple one-page, two-paragraph definition of what each one is. And they use very complicated language to explain it. So, for example, they talk about sensory characteristics as one of the guidelines, but that's basically about not using one sense to communicate something. So, I'll give you an example. If something turns red if it's wrong, or green if it's right, for someone with a colour vision deficiency, which is the most common one they were, which is red green, so it would look grey to start with. If it turned red, it would look grey. If it turned green, it would look grey. So they would not know it had changed colour. Whereas if you change colour and put a tick or an X, you're using two different things. You're using colour and a symbol. Therefore, you're not using one sensory characteristic, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So they are, at the heart, reasonably straightforward, common sense things, but you need, in lots of occasions, someone to explain the common sense thing, because the actual guidelines themselves don't really do it.
Yeah, you mentioned, let's say, color blindness, for example, and I remember that I have a team member in the past that he was colorblind, but actually I only found, like, several years afterwards, because I was sending him emails and telling, oh, you know, that problem that is marked in red or in yellow. And he asked me, like, what yellow? So, yeah, so this is more, let's say, usual than we might think at first sight. And also, in a more recent project in the test automation framework, robot framework, I was helping out the team on the reports. And they are like the green and the red, as you were telling. And actually, for a colorblind person, if we have just that changing of color, if we turn that into black and white, they can be more or less the similar. So we have to find different, contrasts for it to send.
Yeah, contrast is a whole other world. There's a whole world around contrast and things like that. There's lots of guidelines and things around it, but the closer the colours of, say, text and a background are to each other, the harder it is for people to pick up. So there are standards around that, and there are levels that can be easily measured. There's quite a lot of tooling around. But just to come back to your mentioning the person who was colorblind, as language evolves, there are some people in that community who don't like the term colorblind. Some blind people don't like it applied in that way because they can see some colors. They just can't see. There's some on the spectrum they can't see, but they can see some. So the more up to date way of describing that condition is color vision deficiency or CVD.
Okay. Eddie, in picking the question related to principles, most of these principles, they are only applicable for web applications, or can we translate these principles to mobile or to standalone applications?
Yes, so the majority of them can be applied just as they are to mobile applications. But as I said, in June 2019, when WCAG 2.1 was published, they have brought in some mobile-specific ones. Mm-hmm. So in terms of screen orientation, that wasn't really considered because most screens were big enough not to worry about orientation. We now, in modern day, we have these 4K very wide monitors that can be upright or things. So it's mm-hmm. actually been put in for mobile, but now it's translated back to web. So there's an awful lot of crossover between them. But things like we were talking about contrast. We've been talking about sensory characteristics. All of those apply across whatever device you might be using.
Yeah. And you talked about also about a lot of effort manually to understand those principles and to explain those back to the team or someone in your company. But is there something that can help us, like automation can help in doing some of those things, so passing some of this knowledge, or it continues to be mainly manually?
I'm going to say there are quite a lot of different tools out there, but I always put a caveat on tools. The automation tools, when it comes to accessibility, are more prone to false flagging things. So the number one tool I recommend to anybody if they're just starting out on using this is it's called WAVE, which is a web accessibility evaluation tool. And that's a free tool that's been created and distributed by webaim.com. Now, the AIM in WebAIM stands for Accessibility in Mind. They also make the NVDA free screen reader tool. They decided to make their own in competition to, at the time, JAWS was the number one, but was very, very expensive. So it wasn't very accessible for people who didn't have a lot of funds. So non-visual display audio or something like that is the NVDA. But yeah, if you go to WebAIM, they've got lots of information about accessibility. There's the free WAVE tool, there's the free screen reader tool. And that's Windows machine. Basically, if you're using Apple devices, they've got a really good screen reader built in called VoiceOver. So you don't have to go looking for a secondary tool. It's there. It's part of the operating system. So, yeah, in terms of tooling, automated tools you can use basically will run against a web page and they will highlight anything they find in a lot of different areas. So the WAVE tool will highlight contrast. It will highlight heading level elements. It will highlight structures, ARIA labels, if there's missing alt text or not. And it categorizes things as red in one section for warnings, yellow in another section for alerts, but they're all labeled alerts and they're all labeled warnings, so they're using more than one sensory characteristic. So they've thought about that within the tool. And then it goes down in structure. So the first time you run it, it can look overwhelming. I've seen like over 500 things flagged on one web page for one of these runs. But if you think about the structural content on top of that, so if I tell anybody, if ever you're going to try it, if you're going to, it's like somebody listening to this podcast while I'm speaking, he's like searching for this WAVE tool, he's going to give it a go. Available as browser extensions on most of the major platforms. When you first run it, go to the left-hand side of the page where all the categories are shown and then untick everyone but one. And then you're not getting sensory overload of all the things it's showing you. Mind you, if there are something like 100 warnings, you can go to subsections and take away subsections as well. So yeah, you can make it so it's not overwhelming. But the reason why I describe that as the first tool, actually, I think people should try, is you can very easily get to the code and see what the code's doing for each thing it's highlighting. It's available literally as a tab at the bottom of the screen. You can just activate and bring up the code. And the other reason is it has what is fairly unique in being at the forefront in these toolings so far, is it explains why it matters, what's wrong, and how to fix it, literally within the tab on the side of the page. So you can get a lot of information quite quickly on what you're looking at, why it's important, and what to do about it. So that's the one I always point people to first. But there are quite a lot of other ones out there. I suppose the other largest one I would suggest out there is Lighthouse. So as part of the Lighthouse suite that does SEO, does security, does performance, there is an accessibility element. And just to give an example why I say there can be false flags and false readings, there's a web page that exists, and forgive me, I can never remember the name of it, but it's a black web page. It has black elements, it has black text. You run Lighthouse against it, it gets 100 score, 100% score, but it's the most inaccessible page on the internet. In fact, even if you use a screen reader, it's still not very accessible.
Yeah, so that's precisely a good point. Tools in this space, they have their own limitations. Sometimes we hear people saying that tools cover like roughly half of the accessibility issues or something like
that. There's lots of different sources give lots of values. I've seen everything from 25% to 50%. I think more realistically it's probably somewhere between 35% and 40%, but that is being pushed a little bit now. So there are some tools out there that are now using AI. They're in the very early stages, and if you see any advertising that says we have an AI tool that can solve all your accessibility problems, it can't. There's quite a lot of extensions. I'm not going to name any of them because I don't want to get in any legal cease and desist trouble, but there are quite a lot of things that say out there that say add one line of code to your base and you'll be WCAG compliant, and that is blatantly not true, and there's plenty of lawsuits out there that prove it. But browser extensions that say overlays that say they fix all your problems, they don't. It's a false narrative. They're using false advertising, and as I say, I'm not naming any names of any specific ones. But there is a website, again, I'll have to look it up for afterwards, but there's a website out there that explains exactly why overlays are not the silver bullet you're looking for, and it's been signed with a little petition at the bottom to not use them by over 600 accessibility professionals amongst myself. So there is a lot of evidence in the community that these do more harm than good. Unfortunately, in investment rounds, they've got millions and millions of dollars, so they can use advertising to get in front of people and then use their fancy sales techniques and false claims to get in at some quite big companies, to be fair.
Can you give like some concrete examples of, say, limitations in that tools will be very hard to provide in terms of?
So the simplest example out there is related to the way I explain alternative text for images. So there's one of the myths, Cristiano talks about the myths of accessibility at the beginning. One of the myths out there is that every image on the web needs alternative text. And in reality, you need a very good reason to actually put alternative text on an image. And I'm going to explain why. If you've got a flower retail site where you're selling flowers and you have lots of pretty pictures of flowers, you don't need any alternative text for those flowers. Because what are you going to write in the alternative text? You're going to write, it's a pretty bunch of orchids. Right. Well, in the description below it, it's going to say a bunch of orchids between 18 and 20 stems, blah, 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 some very long foreign name, Latin name that's the derivative of where it came from and how much it costs. So the description gives you all the information you need to know what you're going to get. The image doesn't add anything to it, therefore it's decorative. So there's two ways of making a screen reader ignore that image. you can actually put zero alt text between the two quotebacks in the little alt text statement in the code, or you can add an ARIA label, which marks it as decorative. Either way, it will jump over it. Now, a tool will come along, and if you've used the technique that says you've left it blank between the two quotation marks, that will flag as no alt text for that image. So a few years ago, there was a person on the Ministry of Testing Club was pulling the hair out because they had a website with 3,000 images on it, and they were trying to find a way of systematically working out if they all had alternative text on it. So I reached out to this person, had a chat with them, and I said, well, what sort of a website is it? It was a retail website selling batteries. So I said, right, just answer me a few questions and we'll see if we get to the root cause of the problem you've got here. So for every battery you've got that's got an image, is the battery type, size, voltage and everything else, all the details described with it? And they went, oh, yeah, there's a full product description underneath it and the price and everything else. And I said, so do any of your customers need to know that that particular battery is blue or it's golden black or whatever? And he went, well, I wouldn't have thought so. And I said, so what you're saying to me is all these pictures of batteries are decorative images. Therefore, what you should be looking for is having no alt text on any of them. And that took a massive weight off this person's shoulders. They'd been like kept up at night trying to solve this problem, trying to work out how to systematically. They were writing like their own little tools and little things to scroll through. And so they had loads of stress over this thing. And what they actually needed to do was just go through and wipe out any alternative text that was there and then check that no new uploaded image had alternative text on. And that made their life so much easier. So that's one of the myths we talk about when we talk about accessibility, but it's also one of the false flags that automated tools can flag up because they're looking for missing alt text, which could be right in some contexts. And I've had like different people say to me, right, what about charts? What about really complicated charts? How are you going to describe that? And I said, well, do you have tables with all the details in and then a summary of the trends? And they go, oh, yeah. Well, why do you need the chart then? Because the summary of the trends is telling you what the image looks like and the table's giving you all the specific detailed information. And they went, So when it comes to these myths, if you step back about those examples I've just given, they're actually just common sense. But because we wrap it up in a specialism of accessibility and then go, oh, specialisms, you need years of training to do anything to do with a specialist. Like, I wouldn't touch security testing, but yeah, like, every simple tool's got SQL injection. You know what I mean? Everybody who's got a two-step login can try and go to the second step first. You know, we can all do some security testing, just like we can all do some accessibility testing. We can all do performance testing. You name it. I don't think there's a person on the planet, when you name a specialism to do with software testing, we can't do something. So we just have to get that mindset through with accessibility as well. In fact, am I allowed to plug stuff?
That brings back to me to the other myth that I talked about in the beginning, that is, how much does it really cost to invest in accessibility or accessibility testing? Is it that costly? And I'm not just talking about money, of course.
I think it depends about how you look at accessibility. If you look at it as one of the key quality characteristics of your product, like performance and security, people don't generally say, how much does it cost to have security or performance? They go, it's something we need. Now, I would like accessibility to be put into that thing, because if you think about it from the beginning, when you're creating a new feature or whatever it might be, then the cost of accessibility is really low. It, like anything else, if we're thinking, right, we've got a design here, we want to make it intuitive, we want to make it easy to use, we're thinking about all the things at the beginning, it doesn't cost any more for it to be easy to use and you know, get good feedback off customers. So all we're doing is increasing that ease of use, but we're putting it in terms of more types of use. So I did a lot of work at my previous company with the design team about thinking about accessibility during the design stage. So they come up with a design, like a wireframe of something. And I go, well, what does the keyboard journey look like? If someone's just using a keyboard, what does that journey look like? What would it sound like for a screen reader? You know, have we thought about the contrast on elements and stuff like that? And it just became another element of reviewing the design before it came to its final thing. I was at a BBC talk BP before pandemic, and they used the metaphor of a blueberry muffin. So you make a blueberry muffin and then you add the blueberries in afterwards. You're going to have to push them in with your fingers. It's going to look very splodgy and horrible and not be very tasty or desirable. But if you put the blueberries in from the start when you're mixing it up, then you're going to get a nice blueberry, and it hasn't cost you any more to have those blueberries in that, other than knowing that you should put blueberries in. So, yeah, if you get a site that's very inaccessible and you stick with it and you stick to your guns and you're never going to change what it is, then trying to make it accessible, you're going to have a lot higher costs. Just like if you were going to make it performant, you'd have a lot higher costs for refactoring. Just like if you wanted to make it more secure, you'd have higher costs from refactoring. You're going to have a lot higher costs for accessibility in terms of refactoring. The term you used was without limitations. So I don't class myself as disabled, but I definitely have limitations. I wear glasses. I'm past 50 years old. I'm not as fast. My hands are not as nimble as they used to be. So I think everybody in their own way has some form of limitation, whether it's visible or not, whether they consider themselves disabled or not. So without limitations, I'm not going to use that phrase. I'm going to move away from it. So someone who's not part of the disability community, or a person with disability doing accessibility testing, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I just don't think that's all you can do. So I can take the product so far. I can do keyboard testing, and I'm a trained typist. I'm quite fast. I know lots of keyboard shortcuts and stuff like that. I can use a screen reader to review a website. But at the end of the day, I'm not a native screen reader user. So I say I've evaluated it for a screen reader. I don't say it works. I can say from my point of view, it passes the guideline and I can sign something off. But I would always encourage them periodically to get a specialist company that has people with disabilities on the books as their testers. But you don't have to get specialist companies. Like, if you have a decent sized company, all the people in the company have a decent sized reach. They might know somebody who uses software and digital devices in a different way to everybody else. So getting them to review your product, you know, you could do it as a workshop in an afternoon. You could pay them on an ad hoc basis. There's lots of stuff you can do. But getting feedback from people who are native screen reader users is a really useful way of understanding your product. And they will have a different perspective from me. So we had a little chat before the start when you referred to me as an accessibility expert. And I said, I do not refer to myself in that way. I call myself an advocate. Because I want everybody to be doing some. I want everybody to be doing some accessibility testing. I want everybody to have some awareness of it. And I want everybody to have a bit of empathy about how different people use the web. So I will always call myself an advocate. I will never call myself an expert. Somebody who is an expert is somebody who uses it like that day to day because they have to. And their experience will not be exactly the same as somebody else with similar, as you said, limitations. They will both have a slightly different perspective. So there is a survey. There's a number of surveys on the WebAIM site that they do on an annual or biannual basis. And one of them is how people with screen readers interact with the web. And quite often, in the top few ways of interacting with a page is they will scan all their heading levels. So with keyboard shortcuts and a screen reader, you can say, read out all the heading levels on this page. And that will give them a sense of what's on the page and what's there. They might go, what's all the links on a page? So they can say, well, what extra information is this page going to guide me to? Now, again, if you a tool would say, I've got 27 validated links. But if all those links say, click here, the person with the screen reader is not going to say they're validated links. They're going to go, I have no idea where any of these go. Because they've read the link out in isolation. So when it comes to describing a link, if you've got a sentence that tells you all about it and where to go, use the whole sentence as the link. It's not going to cost you any more. It takes no more time to do. But it gives someone with a screen reader who's scanning the page for links full context of what the links are on the page. So yeah, there's as I say, I would always recommend doing some yourselves or in-house. But if you can get people for whom this is a day-to-day thing, this is what they do, or you can engage a specialist company to do what's called a VPAT review, which is a voluntary accessibility product test. That's done against the Webcom Accessibility Guidelines and quite often Section 506 if you get an international one. And Section 506 is of the Americans with Disability Act, so it works for the US and Canada markets. So there are these different legislations that you can test against. And I would always recommend getting specialist people in who can do that for you, and then use that as a template of how you can improve. But there's no reason why, like security.
And talking about service, I was looking at one of those regarding accessibility and looking at what were the reasons why companies were addressing accessibility. And the second one, the second most used motive is law implications. So are there any law implications if we fail to address accessibility issues?
I suppose that depends on your attitude. If you I'm going to be really general on this, so I'm not like pointing at anybody. But it sort of comes across as you don't care about your users if you don't care about accessibility, because it's generally accepted, but maybe not generally communicated, that approximately 15% of the world's population have some form of impairment. And there's a movement called We the 15, which I think their main website is wethe15.org, which is attempting to highlight this. And there's like different initiatives to get the top 500 companies in the world signed up to doing more on accessibility and stuff like that. But if you think you're potentially ignoring 50% of your customer base, then you're potentially ignoring 50% of your revenue opportunities. There's an expression about, I think it's called the purple pound, which is the revenue from the disabled community or from people with disabilities. And the purple pound, now the last concrete thing I saw on this was from a while ago, it's like 2017, 2018, but they estimated the global purple pound was worth about $4 trillion. Now, if your company can ignore a potential cut of $4 trillion, then you're doing yourself a disservice. So if you get the money people who say, well, we don't need to do accessibility because it's going to cost us money, well, you go back with, well, it's potentially 15% additional revenue that we could have. If you get legal people who go, there's no legal reason why we have to do it, you point them to in America, it's the ADA, it's the Americans with Disability Act, that has a Section 506 that covers why it should be done. There's discrimination laws in the UK and equal access. And just from a moral point of view, it's the right thing to do. Like Sir Tim Berners-Lee, who's widely credited with inventing the World Wide Web, said at the beginning, it should be there for people to use regardless of their abilities to use it. So its initial thing was it's there for everybody, no matter how you want to interact with it or what you want to do with it. So the whole point of the World Wide Web is to get everybody using it. And if we're excluding people, then I tend to, when it comes to accessibility, I tend to always give a real world example. Like, I'll just give one off the top of my head. If somebody's got a motor neuron disease, they can often have something called trembling hands, which means it's hard for them to hold a mouse, it's hard for them to hold a drink, different things like that. And I always say, if you're using your mobile phone while commuting on the train and you go over a set of points, both your hands are moving and you're trying to hit a small button on a small screen on a mobile phone, you're replicating that situation. Therefore, if it works better for the person with motor neuron disease, it works better for you. So that's a real world example of somebody who has the need for it to be better and somebody for whom it helps for it to be better. So there's loads of these examples out there that you can use. So I always try and bring it back to a real world example.
So time flies by. So thanks once again for being here with us, Andy. It was great. We learned so much with you, and I guess also our listeners. And hope to see you soon in an event nearby.
Yeah, thank you a lot.
Yep, thank you. I enjoyed the conversation.
Before ending our episode, it's time for some vitamins. We know that in general, they are good for our health. In this case, we'll be talking about vitamin X, where X stands for X-ray. With X-ray, you will be able to define accessibility tests and bring the right visibility to them, either by defining manual scripted tests, exploratory tests, or by gathering results from automation, including tailored automated tests for accessibility. Now that everyone has a common ground to discuss accessibility, it is possible to ignite accessibility conversations that will elevate your product quality. In X-ray documentation, under tutorial tips and tricks section, you'll find tutorials for accessibility testing, namely using ACTS.
And we're reaching at the end of our episode, and it's now time for our closing regards. So as with performance and security issues, accessibility needs to be addressed since the conception of applications, not to increase the costs of correcting the things too late and to ignite an accessibility mindset in your teams. Let's destroy this myth around accessibility, like in performance and security. It is not an extra cause because it needs to be accounted for since the beginning. Don't miss out on our upcoming episodes where we will explore other relevant testing subjects. So see you in our next therapy session. Happy testing!
Happy testing!